Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Talking Natural Capital, the podcast from Galbraith. I'm your host, Matt Finlay, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend, Eleanor Harris. Eleanor, welcome back to another edition.
Hello, it's great to be back.
Yeah, it's great to be back. I'd say it's been a while, but we've actually done a few podcasts in the last month, so we're just drip-feeding them, of course, out to our audiences. But and today's guest, of course, Eleanor, we have tried to have on in the past, a couple of technical issues, but it's good to get going again, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm really excited to have Richard here with us today because every so often we meet up for lunch or a wander around Edinburgh and we always have really interesting conversations. So this is one where I thought it was a good opportunity to bring those interesting conversations to a wider audience.
So now a little bit about our guest for today. Richard Fraser is Minister of Greyfriars Kirk in Edinburgh. He founded and chairs the Grassmarket Community Project, working with some of the most vulnerable people in Edinburgh. He's been influential in the Church of Scotland's decision to officially revive pilgrimage after 450 years. So Richard, why would a Minister of Religion be interested in coming on to a Natural Capital podcast?
Matt, thanks for having me. And it's good to see Eleanor as well. Really enjoy our chats and walks together. And if I was to answer that very bluntly, I think that I would want to refer you to the book of Genesis, right at the start of the Hebrew Bible, where in that myth, that legend about the origins of human life and its relationship to the world, there's a wonderful passage where there are actually two passages that I think are really interesting. One about human beings being put on the earth to tend and serve, which I think is a really interesting one. And the other passage about human beings being put on the earth to have dominion over the earth, to name the plants and animals and to see the earth as something to use. And I've, for many years, wanted to emphasize the former rather than the latter. The idea that human beings have this strange and peculiar responsibility to tend and serve the natural world. And so for me, faith is not really about the life of the spirit so much as about our relationship to the world and to its fabric and to what you know, in Eleanor has introduced me to this idea of natural capital, but it's a term I think that is absolutely fundamental to our spirituality. How do we look after the earth?
That's a great starting point to what I'm hoping to get out of this podcast, which is partly to get our listeners, I hope, thinking a bit differently about some of these concepts about production and consumption and nature and our life. I'm also hoping to hear a bit more about, talk a bit about what you've been doing in some of your projects, Grassmarket and Pilgrimage, and we can explore what that means in practice. But production and consumption is kind of what a lot of what we're talking about. We're working on the land, growing food, and then we're living our lives, running businesses, producing carbon emissions, eating things, consuming resources. How could we start to think a bit differently about that and about material things? And does faith, does Christianity have stuff that to say to that, or is it about more abstract things? And I think you'd say it isn't.
I'm sure it's about many of material. Your listeners will not be necessarily religious people, and I think that's absolutely fair enough. But I think one of the things that we have probably underestimated, especially in contemporary society, is the degree to which our faith tradition has influenced our attitude towards the natural world. And I think that's been one of the, I would want to say that Christianity has actually been part of the problem when it comes to our relationship to the earth. Because I think people have, by and large, been inducted into this idea that the earth is there at our disposal, that it's there for human to serve human beings as opposed to human beings serving the earth. And so part of my ministry and mission is about trying to turn that around and saying that we are part of nature, and that if we have a peculiar role, it's not a role of dominion, more of a role of nurturing and tending. And I guess the other sphere, the other area that I think is really, really important for for me as a person of faith, is to talk and introduce into discourse about climate change and about caring for the environment and about addressing this issue of natural capital, is to recognise that our relationship to nature is not a management issue purely. It's not even a science and technology issue purely. It is actually about building a relationship with the natural world and recognizing that that if we want to have a better relationship, and several scientists have said this talking about climate change, you know, that we have all the technology, we have all the science that would enable us to put an end to the risk to the planet and to thriving human and animal and plant communities. The problem is that we have a culture that is basically based on greed, on selfishness, on lack of awareness. And these are issues on which science is silent. So for me, the thing that will make the biggest difference is if we recover our relationship to the earth as more of a spiritual thing than purely a science and technology thing. Of course, we need the science and we need the technology, but science and technology will not help us to change our mindset when it comes to caring for the environment.
I hear a lot about evidence-based decision-making, and we need, this is a really important phrase, and I think that is really important, that when we make decisions about how to use land, it's on the basis of good science. But actually, very often the people using that phrase, you can see behind that are certain values. I think you can't get away from values. We can't have science without values, which bits of nature are important, what kind of nature we want to look like, or whether it's about whether we're remembering the global impact of our local decisions and how that might ripple through through supply chains across the world. There's all kind of ways in which what we might think is evidence is actually shaped by our values, and actually thinking yeah. more about what those yeah. values are and how we get them right is sure. is equally important. And is that one way that that spirituality could, or do we need spirituality to do that, or is it something we can? Is that a science in itself? How do we shape those values?
I think one of the things that I find really valuable in my own reflection is to reintroduce the idea of reverence. I mean, you know, the natural world in all its different manifestations is a thing of incredible, awesome beauty, complexity and wonder. And it's not just about the earth, it's also about, you know, looking out on a starlit night and you just see the vastness and the extraordinary kind of complexity and wonder of what it is to exist. And there's one scientist that I read many years ago who said that that the extraordinary thing about human beings is that they're that part of the universe, that part of the creation, if you like, that is conscious of itself. And that consciousness awakens wonder, awe, a sense of reverence. And I think that there is a role for faith communities, and it's not just about Christianity, it's about all faith communities and all people of spirituality, to rekindle and reawaken that sense of wonder. Because what that does is it enables people to move away from that notion that the earth is just there for us to plunder, and that it's there for us to serve us, and it's there for our use, which I think is a kind of theme that has run through many centuries of the Christian West, which I think has been a big mistake, quite frankly.
You've been quite vocally critical of Christianity, and while still being on the inside, does it still have stuff to offer us? What are the important bits? And I guess for me, one of the important bits is that story about actually that the divine is in is here on earth, and the idea of that that the earth is sacred, that's yeah. been made sacred, that there's that we, and that eating and drinking is yeah. something that should be at the heart of mm-hmm. spiritual practice, and these seems to me the things that have got a bit lost in recent Christian history that we could be recovering, that perhaps the world could be recovering in a or we could all recover without even needing to talk about it in faith terms. But those mm-hmm. those practices of relationship with the yeah. material world.
I mean, to me, it's really fascinating because I still hear people saying, especially people who are on the edge or out with Christianity, coming up with this idea that God is sitting on some kind of throne up in heaven, and that the only thing that Christians should be interested in is the cure of people's souls. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, I think that's an enormous heresy, if you like, because when you think about the idea of the incarnation, which is the idea that Jesus is somehow or other part of the divine, you know, the Son of God, as the Christians talk about, but actually is born of a human mother and lives a life where he is engaged in physical activities. He's healing people who are blind. He's using mud and then suffers this extraordinary kind of painful death on a cross. There's nothing about that that's purely spiritual. It's actually incredibly visceral and earthy. So how did Christianity end up mm-hmm. talking about everything being sort of, you know, ethereal and just superficial and abstract?
Yeah, abstract yeah. and just, intellectual.
Just beggars yeah. belief that we've ended up like that. So I think that yeah. that the role of the church nowadays is to recover that earthiness that is at the heart of what I think is at the heart of the gospel story, and to recover that sense, which I think is right there at the start. And, you know, if you read the Old Testament, it's so interesting because sometimes if you read like the book of Deuteronomy, I'm sure it's not on everyone's bucket list to read the book of Deuteronomy, but nonetheless, if you read it, it's like an agricultural manual. It's extraordinary, the stuff. Do you know that in the book of Deuteronomy, there's even something that says that you should not feed cloven-hooved animals with byproducts of their own flesh and blood. It's almost as though people in thousands of years ago knew about CJD, or what was called Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, which we had a scare about yeah. in agriculture a few years ago. You know, and yeah. that ancient wisdom and know-how is really valuable yes, for us to kind of to listen to alongside the science.
Mm-hmm. Field margins, don't harvest right up to the edge of your field. That's kind of what we're starting to say now, because that's how you look absolutely. After rivers. looking after the land was really important to the people writing that stuff, because it was a fragile land, and if they were going to live on it, they needed a relationship with it.
And I think at the heart of that Old Testament narrative is this idea of husbandry, the idea that you're there. I'm uncomfortable with the term stewardship, actually, because I think stewardship is a kind of almost like a sort of management role, whereas husbandry is more about a relationship. And you know, I get nervous about our agricultural system in the UK at the moment, where so many people that I know in the agricultural industry are going into these I'm sure there's a lot of good in this, but you know, these kind of agricultural contracts where you get a subcontractor to look after to grow your crops. I think people need to be, I think the best kind of agriculture is where people are husbanding the land, are stakeholders in the thriving of the land that they're looking after. And I sometimes feel that there's a risk of our agriculture becoming a kind of almost like a kind of extractive industry. And there's a wonderful theme that I've tried to sort of read about and explore about this idea that, you know, what you should do is, somebody put it rather succinctly, is that you should live as though you might die tomorrow and farm as though you might live forever.
Yes. Do you think do you think there are too few people involved? That's seems to have been a trend over the years, is we make production more efficient. So three people can now do the work of one person. We mechanize things. we've got a skills shortage, we need to, this is driving efficiency. Is that something that we need to find ways to perhaps change around if we're going to develop a more regenerative, better relationship? Because most of us, and my family, have never in anybody's living memory been working on the land. Most of my friends out with Galbraith, they've got no connection to the land. To us, it's something that kind of goes on over there, and we're quite interested in it, and it provides food on our shelves. But should we all be more, or should more of us be
absolutely
involved?
I mean, I think the technology that we've got is terrific. You know, I was speaking to a farmer who uses satellite technology to discover where he needs to put fertilizer on his land, because these satellite images will show you where, you know, where there's not enough lime or whatever. All of that's great, you know, but by the same token, I think, you know, there have been lots of flaws in the agricultural system we've had, where people in the past, not any longer, but in the past were chasing subsidies rather than chasing markets, where farmers were reading about commodity prices, growing what would bring them in the best subsidy or bring them in the best return for, but we weren't necessarily relating to what was needed in terms of the food system, you know? And I think that's been a, in a sense, you can understand why, because, you know, a lot of businesses, rural businesses, wouldn't function without that kind of support from the state or from the European Union as it was. And so you understand where that's come from, but it's been open to incredible sort of, and I think basically the farmer, the primary producer, has often lost touch with the person who's eating what he produces. And I think if we can bring that relationship back more closely together, so that farmers are actually thinking beyond the farm gate, thinking not about chasing subsidy, but about building relationships, adding value down the food chain and all the rest of it. You know, I love this idea of people not just producing milk, but producing cheese or yogurt and all that sort of stuff. So that farmers are actually, you know, diversifying their businesses, expanding their businesses, and not being, as it were, at the bottom of the gravy train because they're just producing a single product.
Yes. Yeah. And all the wealth shooting out away, far away, somewhere far away. My sense is that things are changing quite fast. The world is going to be very different in 10 years' time. Even in the 2 years I've been here, the way people talk about things is changing. The amount of interest there is in the wider economy in land use, the challenge in the next few years is going to be not so much making change happen. I think things will change, but it's sort of managing change to make sure it happens well. And you've suddenly got this huge global interest in how we use the land, how we tackle biodiversity decline, the carbon footprint of our commodities. And you've got a kind of openness amongst many landowners to do things differently. But there's a real danger that the kind of very large economy, global economy, comes and crashes into the rural economy, which is much more small and doesn't have the capacity. And a lot of my conversations around how do we build that capacity and strengthen that and start to take a lead from the ground up, so that there's some agency amongst farmers and landowners and local communities, rather than stuff coming along and being done to them, because everybody's starting to think about this.
I think one of the things, I mean, I absolutely agree with that. And I have a nephew who's just inherited, or is just taking over, his dad's farm, and he's got very different ideas to his dad, and some of his ideas are just fantastic, you know. And it's what's really important, I think, is to reintroduce into the agricultural community and land ownership a real kind of flair for entrepreneurial activity. How can we be creative, taking into account all these different issues that come to the fore nowadays about sustainability, about how you do agriculture in such a way that it's not denuding the landscape and making it harder and harder, but how you kind of protect it. I mean, I always remember reading a wonderful book by a man called John Morton Boyd, who was the head of sort of Nature Conservancy Council in Scotland. He died many years ago, but one of the things that he talked about was the need not just to conserve the great whales and the giant panda, but to conserve the common earthworm. Because, you know, without that biology in the soil, and this great American farmer Wendell Berry talks about civilization is an agricultural phenomenon. Every human being on the planet, which is what, close to 8 billion people now on the planet, every single person depends on a viable agricultural system. It's the only way that people feed themselves. We're no longer hunter-gatherers, by and large. And so if we get our agriculture long, and this has happened in the past, you know, where we've, you know, there's a writer that I've read who suggests that one of the reasons why the Roman Empire failed was that its agriculture failed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The supply chain's got too long.
And there's a real risk. There's a real risk of things going quite pear-shaped. And I think I think our government has not been very good talking about food security and talking about the, you know, how we ensure that we have a viable soil that continues to be productive for years to come.
I'm interested, you used the word entrepreneurial, need to become more entrepreneurial, and that's sometimes I introduce myself to people and they think I'm a sort of environmental type, and then it turns out I'm really keen on business, and I'm keen on what business can do, and this surprises people and perhaps surprises them that a minister of religion is keen on business. But this is this is interesting, and be interested to know more about that, why what role business has, why it's important, and maybe this is a chance to tell us a bit about the Grass Market project and what you've been developing there, because that's been a bit of a opportunity to showcase some of the theory and practice.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things about entrepreneurship that I think is really interesting, and it's something that I've learned over the years of developing the Grass Market Community Project, is that entrepreneurship is not defined by social class. And some of the most entrepreneurial people that I know are people who have lived, who've been homeless, or who've lived on the streets, or who have struggled with their mental health or whatever. And entrepreneurship is all about being able to use your mind and your creativity to do something that is beneficial, both to yourself in terms of being able to sustain your life, but also beneficial to other people. And for me, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that I have rarely met people, in spite of all the lies we tell ourselves about people that have been long-term unemployed, I have rarely met anyone in the work that I do who is genuinely lazy and genuinely simply wants to sponge off the state. I rarely, if ever, meet people like that. But what I do meet is people who just long to be able to make a positive contribution to their community. And that's how we developed the Grass Market Community Project. And a lot of it is based around hospitality and around, we have about between 300 and 400 members that we support. And many of these people are people with long-term mental health problems, maybe with experience of homelessness, maybe long-term unemployed. And we've created all these social enterprises that people can engage in. We make furniture from discarded church pews. We have this Greyfriars tartan, and people come and make products from the tartan. We've had various growing projects. And it's all based around the idea of hospitality, because the community come together every day through the week and share a meal together. And the meal is cooked by people who are learning cooking skills and learning about nutritional health in the kitchen that we have there. And it's a wonderfully sort of creative atmosphere in which people are engaged both in supporting each other and building a community of mutual care and support, but also learning how, through learning entrepreneurial skills and learning the strength that they have within them, the creativity and imagination and opportunity to contribute positively to their community and the wider community, people's confidence builds and people's sense of their own worth builds up. And all of that, I think, is something that our whole society needs to do. We should not be warehousing people, just giving them handouts and offering them kind of support that usually doesn't make any difference. Instead, we should be tapping into what people can contribute, what strength people have got. And I'm a great advocate of refusing to label people, refusing to say, well, that's the person that's got an alcohol problem, that's the person who's been on heroin for 30 years, that's the person whose mental health is skewed. People are people. And those problems that people face are often just the symptoms of poverty, of a lack of nurture in early years, of a whole host of different issues that people face. But fundamentally, most people want to be a positive contributor to their community. And that's what the grass market community is all about.
This has been something I've been thinking about. My observation is that the countryside can be a very tribal place, and people label themselves as farmers or foresters or conservationists or the local community or the landowner, and then label the others as something else, and will stereotype who they are. And I increasingly believe that natural capital development, the regeneration, needs to be place-based, not tribe-based, and that places, whether it's a city or a region in Scotland or a catchment, will have all kinds of people in it. And that actually the opportunity is for them to come together and start to develop things. And this is far from just me. This is very much a Scotland, there's a lot of this in Scotland. And very often people think, gosh, this is hard work. We're going to have to, before we can even do anything, we're going to have to do all this engagement, and we're going to have to go and talk to those people that we've never talked to before. And we don't know if they're going to be interested. And but is there a great opportunity in there? Is that where the... is that where the new ideas are going to come from? Because that's sort of my hunch, and I think that's what you're seeing at the grass market.
You're absolutely spot on there. I mean, tribalism is a nightmare in Scotland. You know, I mean, I've heard landowners muttering about the RSPB and other people talking about, you know, whether we should encourage hunting and shooting, and whether we should encourage something completely different. And sometimes these groups never seem to want to kind of communicate with each other. Instead, they just sort of almost feel that they're at war with one another. And it's so tragic. And I guess that from the spiritual tradition that I'm trying to advocate and that I come from, I think what we're trying to say is that, you know, especially when it comes to living in, I mean, as you put it, Eleanor, about the Hebrew people living in that Israel, they were living in a marginal land. And therefore, it became really important for people to recognize that that if you overcrop, if you don't look after the land, then, you know, your civilization is liable to crumble. And I think that what we need to do is we need to recognize that that's a global question now. You know, there's this global question mark over how we can continue to thrive as a human community and the rest of the natural community thrive. And the only way to do that, I think, is to try to overcome these tribal kind of differences that mean that people don't communicate effectively. Because the shared goal that we all ought to share, I think, is how can the human community and the natural community around us, how can that thrive? How can that be sustained? And how can that continue to serve us as we serve it in different ways? And I guess, you know, in the midst of that kind of dialogue, we need honest brokers. And I remember, for example, we hosted at Greyfriars many years ago now, we hosted a dinner, which we called a Windy Burns Supper. It was in roundabout Burns time. And it was all about a debate about wind farms. And there's a huge kind of debate. Some people are pro them, Some people are absolutely anti them. And we had about 90 people, and we organised a dinner in Greyfriars. And we had people standing up and speaking pro-wind farm and anti-wind farm. And at the end of that evening, several people came up to me and said, you know, it was wonderful to be in this place where we all had to behave ourselves because we felt we were in a church and it felt like we couldn't start shouting and being rude to one another. But actually what happened in that context was we started hearing each other. And that was really, really important. So I think there is a role for faith communities and for other agencies to be that kind of, to create that space where all these tribes can begin to kind of not just advocate their case, but actually hear each other. And I think that's something that we really need. If we all have the same objective, the same long-term objective of a thriving world community.
That idea of properly listening is something I think about a lot, because I don't think I'm very good at it naturally. Much rather be talking. And I was at a Buddhist event, and Buddhism is, I find very interesting, has done quite a lot of sort of reinventing of itself in a way perhaps the church needs to do a bit more of, and think about how can this ancient religion, it's about the same age as Christianity as a religion, how can it be relevant to modern time, and thinking about how does Buddhist practice fit with Western psychology, and what can it learn from Western psychology or from psychology, but then these very strong practices of often very physical, about breathing and drinking tea and walking and connecting with the physical realm. But we were, one of the practices was called Dharma sharing, and it was the group, you could say what you wanted to say in the group, and if you had some insight you wanted to share, we had quite a long silence before anyone dared to say anything, but once we got going, people opened up. But when you started to speak, you would put your hands together and bow, so that you'd signal you're about to speak, and everyone else would bow back to you to signal that they'd recognize you're about to speak, and then you could speak, and everyone else had to just listen, and you could speak for as long as you liked, and everyone would listen, and then you would bow again to signal that you'd finished speaking, and everyone would respond. And it meant you didn't have what we always have in ordinary conversations of someone starts saying something and then someone jumps in and interrupts and they haven't really been listening. Yeah. They really want to say what they're thinking. And it was, I found that very interesting, not having done that very often, to see that different way of listening. And it wasn't like someone was giving a talk and we all had to listen to the talk. It was more like a conversation, but very, very structured. So I think, but I'd be interested in what practical advice, you know, how do, if people are listening to this and they're thinking about developing a project and they're thinking, well, I need to involve other people, I don't know where to begin, and I don't have the confidence, and suppose they don't like me and they'll stereotype me. How do people start to reach out, to break down those tribes, to have those conversations? Maybe the dinner is an important part.
Well, I think
part
that certainly is one opportunity, but the other one that immediately springs to mind is to go for a walk. A great phrase that came from, I think, from someone like Diogenes the Cynic was solvitur ambulando. It is solved by walking. And that's both corporate as well as personal. And I think there's something really interesting about that. I mean, I've for a long time had a real interest in pilgrimage walking. And there's so many things that happen when people kind of like sort of drop their agenda. And a lot of this is about just taking the time that it needs. And sometimes we're always too busy to think that actually, you know, why go for a walk with someone that you disagree with? Well, it's amazing the difference that and how much more productive and effective people can be if they've actually built a relationship with a person rather than just slag them off from over a wall. And the thing that I find really interesting about this whole idea of pilgrimage is that the landscape itself can become a participant in the conversation, because there's so much about landscape that has its own narrative and it tells its own stories, both natural and the way in which human beings have impacted a landscape. So walking, journeying through it with other people and interpreting its stories and hearing its stories can be really valuable. Assessing its strengths and its weaknesses, its vulnerabilities and what have you, and just learning to appreciate it, you know, to hear birdsong. You know, one of the areas that I know really well in Perthshire, 35 years ago, you'd see lapwings, curlews up in the hill, and oyster catchers. There are no lapwings anymore. There are no curlews. And there's so many birds that are just not there anymore, you know. Being alert to what we're actually doing to our landscape is really important. And I guess, the best thing that we can do sometimes is, so often what people do is they meet at, well, I mean, there's a sort of physical thing that someone showed me once, which is, you know, you can meet eye to eye and face to face, but so often what our meetings are not eye to eye and not face to face because we've got our agenda, we've got our prejudices, and so we're not meeting eye to eye. We're just seeing the problem, seeing the person that we disagree with. Finding mechanisms like the one you've described, Eleanor, that enables people to have different kinds of conversations where there's real, genuine listening without sort of retorting and without necessarily shouting another person down, I think is absolutely crucial, and we don't do it enough.
Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between going for a walk and going on a pilgrimage, and what's the difference between the Scottish Pilgrim Routes network that you've been helping to revive and any ordinary path network? I think perhaps many people listening will see a pilgrimage as it's a journey to a place, and when you get to the place, you get to the sacred place and the bones of the saint, and you get some kind of spiritual result. The way you're talking about it is more about the walk. What makes it a pilgrimage?
I think sometimes pilgrimage can be a bit of a sort of loaded term because, you know, people imagine that if you go on a pilgrimage, you have to be religious. But actually, there's a lot of people go on pilgrimage walks, especially to places like Santiago in Spain, who are not necessarily religious at all. But what they will often say at the end of it is, my goodness, the journey really changed me. The people I met, the conversations I had, the landscape that I walked through, the story it told me, all of that has had its impact. And, you know, a lot of people who have gone on pilgrimages say that the destination is less important than the journey, because home is the journey. And it's what happens to you as you open yourself to fresh ideas, to different perspectives, to people who maybe have a different experience than you. All of that has an incredibly enriching impact. And I think I'm a great advocate of this, because not necessarily from a purely religious formation point of view, but just from the point of view of how human beings relate to one another. And we went, for example, with a group from the Grass Market Community Project last September, and we walked the West Highland Way. And a lot of the people on that walk were people who were not necessarily terribly fit. There were people who had never really done anything like this before, never really had the opportunity to do that kind of thing before. But giving people that opportunity to be in that landscape and to be in conversation with one another as the day passed, to challenge themselves physically, to hear each other's stories, all of that was incredibly enriching, incredibly fruitful. And so we just need to encourage people to get out of their silos and go and meet the person that you disagree with most and actually say, let's go for a walk together. Let's try and hear each other. Why not?
Maybe we need to find a way to do a walking podcast. We might have to work on our technology, but that'd be interesting. I wrote down a question about, and this is coming out of, I've had a few conversations where with people working, I guess, in my field, there's quite the field of the natural capital specialist in a business, and it is an expanding one. And I'm always meeting people who've fairly recently got a new job as the sustainability person, and they're working with this business, some of whom are skeptical and some aren't. And sometimes the conversation gets onto spirituality or religion, and it's intriguing how often, often it doesn't, talking about carbon targets or whatever, but when it does, how often people are interested in that, and how it's often people younger than me, how spirituality is something they're thinking about and finding important. And as they're wrestling with being this kind of prophetic voice in a company or in an organization, trying to convince people that climate change is important and that this is urgent, and they're struggling with seeing that these existential crises going on, the decline of biodiversity, and how can I get people to take it seriously. And seems to me there is a growing role demand for a spiritual aspect to this, a faith way of talking about things. And I love that idea that of the world of Deuteronomy, that these religious conversations first started in this fragile landscape, and having to live on the land, and now here we are on this fragile earth, and it's becoming relevant again. Is that a sense that, do you get that sense that spirit religion has been in decline, or it's bubbling up again?
Yeah,
at this point.
I mean, it's so interesting, you know. One of the things that I find, I just picked up this, I got this card, listeners won't be able to see it, but it was a card from a friend of mine who worked for Historic Scotland for many years, and I did some work with him, and sent me this beautiful picture of a house, and it's from Galston in Ayrshire, and it's a drawing that he did. And what he says here is that for me there's evidence, because this building that I'm showing you now on screen is a weaver's cottage. And what's interesting is that there's a reaping machine that was designed by a minister called Patrick Bell. And then there was this minister called Robert Stirling in Galston in Ayrshire, who devised a hot air engine which can be used as a heat pump and is the direct ancestor of the modern heat pump technology. And then I think about a very famous book Selborne, Natural History of Selborne by Gilbert White, I think it is.
Gilbert White, yes.
One of the things I think that what we have sometimes failed to do in the church is to do what many of these people in the past did, which was to translate our insight and wisdom into practical manifestations that are beneficial to human flourishing and to the well-being of the planet. And instead, one of the reasons I think that the church is in decline is that people look at it and they think, well, these people only seem to be interested in human souls, only seem to be interested in recruiting people to their churches and getting bums on seats on a Sunday, and not translating that faith into practical expressions of what helps a community to flourish. And yet there are examples like this chap who invented this heat pump, or like a chap who invented a reaping machine, who basically, you know, were using their faith to find ways in which practically we could make a difference in human flourishing. And I think if people of faith got back to that idea of, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be worshipping and we shouldn't be enabling people to we shouldn't be encouraging people to come to church and all that sort of stuff. But if it's just about that, then a lot of people are going to say, well, what's the point of all of that? You know, it has to have some physical manifestation. And if you go back to the Gospels, you know, that's basically what Jesus was doing. He was making a positive difference in people's lives. He wasn't just telling people that they needed to kind of become, synagogue goers, and what have you. So there's something very practical about faith that has to do with, you know, if you want to use the term natural capital, if you want to use the term of, you know, what is it that faith teaches us about how we can live our lives well and live our lives justly and live our lives fairly. That seems to me to be really, really important and absolutely the heart of what makes faith meaningful and relevant in people's lives.
Maybe one of the best things that our listeners can do for the church as they're developing, or for faith when they're developing their natural capital projects, is to get the local church, the local faith communities involved and say, come on, get out of your church, come out here, let's come with us for a walk, and we want you participating in this as well.
Well, there's a friend of mine just she's a vicar in the Church of England, and she's just started down in Worcestershire an initiative called Sustainable Church Flowers. What you know, flower arranging is a great sort of ecclesiastical pastime for many people. And yet, you know, these flowers are sometimes flown in halfway across the world. They're using that stuff called Oasis, which is incredibly bad for the environment because there's a huge amount of plastic in Oasis. And there's also churches with bits of land. So there's a woman here in Edinburgh, in Granton, who started a church flower growing business. She's just at the big early stages of developing that. And it seems to me that, you know, there's a wonderful opportunity for us to kind of to reflect on our practices and to think, how can we do things in a more sustainable, more viable and more responsible way? And I certainly believe that initiatives like that, and the other thing that's really interesting about that is once this woman in Granton started digging up the churchyard, I mean, it's not a burial ground, but it's a fertile bit of ground. She found that people in the community were coming saying, well, what are you up to? And they said, she said, well, I'm growing flowers so that we're not having to buy them from supermarkets or buy them from, you know, from Ecuador or something like that, and being flown across the planet. People said, oh, well, I'll get involved in that. I'll help you with that. So she's building a team. So these kind of local grants, and the church, you know, the Church of Scotland and other churches have got land. I think there's 13,000 hectares of glebe land in the Church of Scotland alone, much of which could probably be used quite productively.
Sure. Yeah, this is an ongoing conversation for us, but I'd love to hear, you know, if listeners are just sparking ideas, and listeners, it'd be great if you would get in touch with us and let us know what you think, because this has been a bit of a different direction for our podcast. So I'm interested to see how it will be received. Matt? What were you thinking of that, Matt, quietly in the corner?
I found that really insightful, Eleanor, honestly. I did. I thought a lot of it is so relatable to, like, just everyday the human society, you know, the work, the role the church plays within the natural environment, I suppose, and encouraging. And so, you know, when you strip it all back, and, you know, if there's listeners out there who aren't particularly religious, I'm sure they can relate to it. And then you can look at the projects like the Grass Market project, which is obviously teaching about working in the community. And it's great to see as well, obviously, that you, Richard, are leading on that in Edinburgh. And then there's been something really insightful.
Great. Good. Oh, well, I'm glad you found that helpful. That's great.
Just before we go, I'll obviously thank you, Richard, for coming on and giving us your time and your words today. If listeners do want to get in touch with you, how should they go about it? Not just yourself, obviously, you've got a few teams as well out there. What's the best way of doing that?
You can email me, minister@greyfriarskirk.com, and that will find me. I think it's a pretty straightforward email address, so that's one way of getting in touch. You can also read my book about pilgrimage, which is called Travels with a Stick, and it's available from Amazon and all good bookshops. Well, it used to be anyway. It's probably getting a bit dusty on the shelves, but it's sold quite well. It's in a second print run, so it's that's another bit of a reflection on some of these issues that we've covered today. Where if people want to read a bit deeper and a bit further into that, and our website for the Grass Market Community Project is grassmarket.org, and you can find out more about the activities that go on there, just at Grass Market, www.grassmarket.org.
Well, I think that's more or less just about all we've got time for. Eleanor, thank you as always for today.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, it's been very good. And I'm sure, Richard, but we'll maybe look at having you back on again in the future. But it would always be good, actually, to have maybe an update on how you're getting on with your project at Grass Market. And sure. If there's anything else going on.
Great. No, happy to do that. Glad to be in touch.
We'll be back soon with another podcast from Galbraith. Until then, make sure to subscribe to Talking Natural Capital just so you never miss an episode. Follow us on social media at Galbraith across Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and LinkedIn. If you have a question for Eleanor in our Ask Me Anything segment, please get in touch. I've been Matt Finlay, she's been Alan Harris, and this has been Talking Natural Capital.